From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now! Broadcasting from Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Another Iraq War soldier has returned from the war sick and positive for depleted uranium, only this time he's had a baby. His wife has had a baby since his return, who was born missing three fingers on one hand.
Today, Juan Gonzalez's expose in the New York Daily News. We'll speak with Juan and the soldier just returned from Iraq. Then we go to Santa Cruz, California, where the country's longest standing 24-hour pirate radio station was just raided and shut down by the FCC. And static in Silver City. Michael Savage, Bill O'Reilly, and Rush Limbaugh weren't enough. Local advertisers threatened to pull all of their commercials from a radio station in New Mexico that airs a liberal radio talk show as well.
Radio Free Silver was bringing the voice of the alternative community to Silver City and Grant County, and we had a little bit of, as Matt Ronald said, economic terrorism.
And the National Museum of the American Indian takes the last spot in the National Mall in Washington, D.C. We'll speak with a leading feminist Native American writer here in New Mexico.
A wonderful thing, that museum. What thing I like the best about it is it's directly facing defiantly the Capitol. And the Capitol looks Roman, and ours looks Mesas.
All that and more coming up. The Financial Times is reporting that Iraq's oil-rich southern provinces are considering plans to set up an autonomous region. The move could threaten Iraq's unity and present the Bush administration another major setback in Iraq. Members of the Municipal Council of Basra have reportedly been holding talks with officials in the provinces of Misar and Dikhar. The three provinces account for more than 80% of the known oil reserves in Iraq. The three provinces have complained they're not fairly represented in Baghdad. Only one member of Prime Minister Iyad Alawi's cabinet is from the southern region. In other Iraq news, at least 37 people have died in a string of bombings near a U.S. convoy in Baghdad. More than 50 people were wounded in the attacks. The bombings reportedly occurred during a ceremony marking the opening of a new sewage system. It's unclear who died in the attacks. News reports indicated a U.S. helicopter evacuated some of the survivors. Earlier today, a car bomb exploded near the Abu Ghraib prison, killing two Iraqi police officers and one U.S. soldier. In Fallujah, U.S. air raids continued last night. Iraqi doctors reported at least three civilians were killed. Newsweek is reporting that the Department of Homeland Security is considering detaining 2,000 foreigners, mostly from Middle East and Muslim nations, ahead of the November election. The department reportedly has soft intelligence on these individuals that suggests they could have possible terror connections, and that they may have visa violations. Such a roundup would be the largest since shortly after the September 11th attacks. This comes as the federal government launches a massive campaign to increase security before the elections. On Monday, the Department of Homeland Security sent security bulletins to all 50 states. Meanwhile, the Washington Post is reporting the Bush administration is supporting a provision in a new House intelligence bill that would allow U.S. authorities to deport certain foreigners to countries where they're likely to be tortured or abused, even though the action is prohibited by international laws against torture that the United States signed 20 years ago. The provision appears as part of the massive bill introduced Friday by Republican House Speaker Dennis Hastert. According to the Post, it would apply to non-U.S. citizens who are suspected of having links to terrorist organizations, but have not somehow been tried or convicted of any charges. Human rights groups and members of Congress opposed to the provision say it could result in the torture of hundreds of people now held in the United States. Tom Olenowski of Human Rights Watch said, quote, since Abu Ghraib, everyone from the president to the Pentagon to Congress has said the United States does not have a policy of torture. If this passes, we'll have a policy of tolerating torture. A federal judge yesterday ruled a major provision of the USA Patriot Act is unconstitutional. Another, Anthony Romero of the American Civil Liberties Union, said the decision is a, quote, stunning victory against the John Ashcroft Justice Department. The New York-based federal judge, Victor Marrero, ruled against a provision that allowed the government to secretly obtain internet and other electronic records from private communication firms without a court order. The judge ruled the provision violated both free speech guarantees and protection against unreasonable searches. In the suit, the ACLU argued that the law gave the FBI unchecked power to obtain private information and gave the recipient no opportunity to challenge the request. Yesterday's ruling marks only the second time in the past 3 years that a federal court has rejected portions of the Patriot Act. More than 350 cities and counties now have passed resolutions condemning the Patriot Act. The Russian government has approved the Kyoto Protocol, designed to control greenhouse gas emissions in order to stop global warming. Environmental groups have expressed hope that Russia's decision may increase the pressure on the United States and Australia to sign the treaty. The United States, which is the world's biggest polluter, pulled out of the treaty 3 years ago. Meanwhile, the New York Times is reporting a major new governmental study has found that global warming is likely to produce a significant increase in intensity, as environmental groups have expressed the hope that Russia's decision may increase the pressure on the United States. The United States, the world's biggest polluter, pulled out 3 years ago. The issue of the New York Times reporting a major new governmental study found that global warming likely to produce increase in intensity and rainfall of hurricanes in coming decades. The study is being described as the most comprehensive computer analysis of hurricanes to date. It was done in Princeton at the Commerce Department's Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory. One leading scientist at MIT said the study offers a definitive link between global warming and larger hurricanes. Hurricane expert Dr. Kerry Emanuel said, quote, this clinches the issue. The study did not determine whether hurricanes would form more or less frequently due to global warming. And for the first time in 4 years, Israeli troops have entered the Gaza's largest refugee camp, Jabalia. In heavy fighting, 9 Palestinians and 3 Israelis have died over the last 24 hours. At least 72 Palestinians have been wounded, and Israeli bulldozers have destroyed 12 Palestinian homes. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has ordered reinforcements into Gaza. On Tuesday, as Palestinians mark the 4th anniversary of the Intifada, Israel launched a large military operation in northern Gaza by sending in 110 tanks, armed personnel carriers, and bulldozers. Yesterday, Palestinian rockets killed 2 Israeli children and wounded other people in the town of Sderot. The rockets fell as people gathered to celebrate the festival of Sukkot. And the U.S. government has denied visas to 61 Cuban scholars who are scheduled to take part in the Latin American Studies Association convention next week in Las Vegas. Meanwhile, the U.S. has allowed 3 anti-Castro militants who were recently released from a Panamanian jail to enter the United States. The 3 men were arrested after being caught attempting to assassinate Cuban President Fidel Castro during his visit to Panama. A column in today's New York Daily News summarizes the U.S. policy towards Cubans as this, quote, terrorists, yes, scholars, no.
Kim and John Army, cause you had no place to go. There ain't nobody hiring here since I'm jumping down to Mexico. Reckon that learning self-trade made me see the world. Moved to the city someday, married a black-haired girl. Somebody somewhere had another plan. Now he's got a rifle in his hand, rolling in a bag, then wondering how he got this far. Just another poor boy off to fight a rich man's war. Bobby had an eagle and a flag tattooed on his arm. Red, white, and blue to the bone when landing Kandahar. I left behind a pretty young wife and a baby girl.
Steve Earle's Rich Man's War. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting from Albuquerque, New Mexico, from the PBS studios of KNME here in Albuquerque. Juan Gonzalez is in New York. For the last 5 months, Juan has chronicled the plight of soldiers who've returned from Iraq with mysterious illnesses. His exclusive groundbreaking investigation in April found that depleted uranium contamination was far more widespread in the military than the Pentagon would admit. Well, in a major expose in Wednesday's Daily News, Juan uncovered the story of how a newborn baby may have suffered deformities because her father was exposed to depleted uranium while in Iraq. Juan, why don't you take it away?
Well, Army Guard Specialist Gerard Darren Matthews tested positive for depleted uranium in a test conducted by the Daily News recently. He returned from Iraq in September, was evacuated, actually, because of unexplained illnesses. He suffered constant migraine headaches, blurred vision, blackouts, and a burning sensation every time he urinated. And he was shipped out by the Army to Walter Reed Medical Center first and then was demobilized. But in September, his wife became pregnant, and on June 29th, the baby Victoria Claudette, June 28th, the baby Victoria Claudette was born missing three fingers and most of her right hand. The family believes the deformities are the result of his depleted uranium contamination, and the Daily News ran the story in yesterday's newspaper. And we're joined today by Gerard Darren Matthews. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, sir.
Gerard, can you tell me a little bit, tell us, the listeners and the viewers, a little bit about your experiences? When did you get to Iraq? What did you do when you were there? And how did your illnesses develop?
Well, I was deployed January 15th of 2003, and I moved out, shipped out from Fort Dix April 10th, arrived in country April 11th, stayed over there, came home on emergency leave in August, and that's when I started receiving the problems. Initially, I was getting swelling and burning sensation, but I thought it was attributed to the heat, being in a high heat environment. And as time went on, going back, it started getting worse. I started getting swelling in my face, blurred vision because I'm a truck driver. And I felt like I saw my face, two different faces. If you put a cross-section down the middle of my face, it's like I'm seeing a right-side facial droop coupled with blurred vision. And it was very traumatic because I've never had any problems before. I'm a very healthy person. I'm a runner. And to take this and now I have a child with a problem and getting a result, it's really traumatic.
What did the what did you do? You said you were a truck driver, but where do you think the exposures might have come from?
Well, in shipment of exploded material, where it be tank parts, Humvee parts, you name it, from Kuwait, going north, back and forth. That could be attributed to what I have. Plus, I believe it could be from things that happened from the prior war that's been hidden or mistargeted shrapnel that we inhaled. I mean, I really and truly, I'm still trying to mind-boggle by the whole thing.
Now, the military gave you in May a 40% disability pension. Could you what did they diagnose as what your problems were?
They gave me 30% for the migraines. They call it and they gave me 10% for angioedema, which is the swelling on my face, which occurs off and on. And for the last, since I've gotten this, I think, I don't know if it's just my mind playing games, but it seems like every day under my eye it's been swollen for some odd reason.
And when did you learn that your baby was going to be born deformed?
March 12th at Lenox Hill Hospital, a doctor by the name of Michael Devon is one of the best doctors rated in Newsweek. He found the anomaly, and he told me about it, and they gave me options of having an abortion. And I figured with a child now being 5 months, it's like killing someone. I've been over there in Iraq. I didn't kill anybody, and now I'm going to try to do something to my own daughter. Eventually, she conceived a baby, and it's healthy except for the hand. We don't know if there's going to be any cognitive issues in the long run, but, I mean, you should see the hand. It's just it's unbelievable.
We're also joined by Staff Sergeant Ray Ramos, who was part of the group of soldiers that we tested in the Daily News actually earlier this year. Out of 9 soldiers who had returned sick from Iraq and were stationed at Fort Dix, and the Army couldn't tell them what was wrong with them. Ray was one of them. Actually, he was at Walter Reed Medical Center. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Warren.
Now, you've just recently gotten out of the Army, finally, I think, in July, isn't it?
Yes, July 31st.
What did they finally figure out was wrong with you?
Well, they gave me a 30% disability, well, temporary disability, for my migraine headaches, and they linked it together with post-traumatic stress disorder. The other illnesses, they ruled out. They said they were medically acceptable, including the depleted uranium exposure.
Right there, and the Army conducted several tests after the Daily News. In our testing, did find DU in you. The Army claims that their testing did not. In fact, I think they finally said that there were 77 soldiers that they tested as a result of the Daily News articles that came out who requested testing, and they found no one positive, even though we found 4 out of 9 that were positive for DU.
Yes, they told me my levels were low. They were too low to even test, pick up the uranium.
Now, let me ask you this. What was the reaction in when you were still in the Army at Walter Reed when they found out you had gone out for independent testing? Can you talk a little bit about
well,
that?
Well, yes. I was actually grilled for about a couple hours. I was asked by Colonel Hack, Lieutenant Colonel Mercer. I was questioned as to why I felt that I was exposed to depleted uranium. I was asked if I was in any burning vehicles or I was around any vehicles that had been struck by uranium rounds. And my response to them was that I was not aware of any exploded ordnance around me, although we had patrols that had gone out and had expressed that, you know, they would see things. It wasn't too receptive when they first started questioning me about it.
And when they found out you'd gone to the Daily News?
Yes, they were very curious. They were like, why did I go seek independent help? And my answer to them was when I asked about the depleted uranium in Fort Dix, I was told that I didn't have anything to worry about and that there was no known testing for depleted uranium.
Now, I'd like to ask Gerard also. You went to the Army in April, and you did submit a urine sample and asked for it to be tested for DU. What happened to the Army's test?
It's so-called unfounded. They don't know where the specimen is, and I've been contacted since the article by Walter Reed, and they're wanting to have me redo the tests. And they'll send the bottles at home and for me to send it to West Point. But in lieu of the article, is that what has stirred the pot a little bit?
In other words, they lost your sample, or they claim that they don't have a record that you ever gave it back in April.
Yes, Mr. Gonzalez.
And now that the article came out, now they're calling you that they want to test you now.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of late. If one thing is already stating that I have it, what's the use of another test? It's still going to state that I have it.
One of the interesting things, obviously, is that there has been a lot of, in New York, quite a few of the political leaders, Congressman Elliot Engels, Senator Hillary Clinton, and Chuck Schumer have gotten involved. And actually, Senator Clinton got a new bill passed just this summer requesting systematic testing of all soldiers when they return from Iraq as well as when they leave. And yet we still have a situation with you where the Army has lost a test that you gave them, a sample that you gave them 5 months ago. Senator Clinton issued a statement yesterday saying that she's still troubled by the failure of the Army to be able to adequately screen troops when they leave and when they return from Iraq. So we'll be continuing to cover this issue of depleted uranium. The military continues to insist that no soldiers that they have tested who have returned from Iraq have tested positive, and yet in the Daily News now, we have out of 10 soldiers that we've tested. And I should add that in your test, we actually sent three different samples to a lab in Germany, two of reporters and one of Gerard's, and we didn't identify any of the three. The two reporters came back completely negative. Only Gerard's came back positive.
Juan, congratulations on once again stellar work in this investigation. Yesterday in the New York Daily News, when you did this, they went through the effects of this report. At the request of the news, 9 soldiers from New York Army National Guard serving in Iraq tested for radiation from depleted uranium shells. 4 of the ailing GIs tested positive. The day after your story appeared, Army officials rushed to test all returning members of the company, the 442nd Military Police, based in Rockland County. By week's end, the scandal had reverberated all the way to Albany, as Governor Pataki joined the list of politicians calling for the Pentagon to do a better job of testing and treating 6 soldiers returning from the war. Your expose sparked a huge demand for testing. By mid-April, 800 GIs had given the Army the urine samples, and hundreds more were waiting for appointments. 2 weeks later, the Pentagon claimed that none of the soldiers from the 442nd had tested positive for depleted uranium, but the news experts found significant problems with the testing methods. And finally, I wanted to just ask Gerard Darren Matthew, what are you demanding now for your daughter?
Just take care of her.
We'll go to that after. Just to take care of her. And what has the Army said about that?
The Army is now willing to give her a test and my wife a test all of a sudden. And my TRICARE insurance runs out November 2nd. But they're willing to do whatever it takes in order to help all of a sudden.
Well, we want to thank you for being there, Gerard Darren Matthew, guardsman sent home from Iraq, suffering from mysterious illness. Now his daughter, born, is missing 3 fingers, most of her right hand. Ray Ramos, deployed in Iraq with the 442nd Military Police. Thank you very much for being with us. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
It was back in 1942, I was a member of a good platoon. We were on maneuvers in Louisiana one night by the light of the moon. The captain told us to ford a river, that's how it all begun. We were knee-deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. The sergeant said, sir, are you sure this is the best way back to the base? Sergeant, go on, I forded this river about a mile above this place. It'll be a little soggy, but just keep slogging, we'll soon be on dry ground. We were waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. The sergeant said, sir, with all this equipment, no man will be able to swim. Sergeant, don't be a nervous Nelly, the captain said to him. All we need is a little determination, men, follow me, I'll lead on. We were neck deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on.
Pete Seeger, Waist Deep in the Big Muddy, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Juan Gonzalez is in New York as we talk about his most recent expose, depleted uranium exposure of U.S. soldiers in Iraq. Juan, this is such an important report. Our guest, Gerard Darren Matthews, who returned from Iraq, his wife got pregnant and born was Victoria Claudette, June 28th. The baby is missing three fingers, most of her right hand. Ray Ramos with us, deployed in Iraq with the 442nd Military Police. What's most stunning about the effect of the expose, Juan, is that in all of these cases, these men have and their families have not been dealt with until you pushed. Ray Ramos, Juan was asking you this question before the break, but can you describe the scene when, after the expose came out in the New York Daily News, you were brought into this room with at Walter Reed, where they grilled you? I mean, how many doctors, military people were in the room, and were they accusing you of going outside the military to do these tests?
Well, I was in the room with about three military personnel and a civilian. Basically, the questioning was to the effect of why I felt I was exposed. I didn't have anything to worry about unless I was in a burning vehicle that had just been hit with a uranium round. Who was I? Who did I get the testing from? And how much did it cost me to get the testing done? Things to that effect.
As I recall, there was one doctor in the room, one officer who you had asked months before for testing and had turned you down, and you reminded them of that several months back, that was the very doctor you had said, listen, I'd like to be tested, right?
Yes, and at that time I got the same answer, that I didn't have anything to worry about, that unless I was, again, in direct contact with the uranium round, that I wouldn't be exposed.
See, and I think this is important to understand, because the Army and the spin that it is giving this story, Amy, continues to say, well, these soldiers were not in direct contact. They were National Guardsmen who were doing basically support work for the combat troops. But it's precisely the fact that they were not in combat, and yet many of them are turning up positive, that would suggest that there's a much more widespread problem, especially among the combat troops who were directly involved. Many of these men were sleeping in their next to burned out tanks, or in Darren's case, were transporting these burned out tanks to bases in Kuwait. And what about those soldiers who were even more closely involved in combat? And the Army's testing, the problem with the testing, according to the experts that I've consulted in nuclear medicine and in radiation, is that the Army is continually referring, when they do testing of soldiers, to the total uranium content that they find in urine, of natural uranium. And if that's not a high level from their perspective, they don't even bother to look for depleted uranium. And the experts that I have talked to say that all of us ingest uranium to one level or another in the food that we eat or in the water that we drink. But that uranium gets excreted within 24 hours from the body. However, if you breathe in depleted uranium and it gets into your lungs, it does not get excreted as quickly. It can stay in your lungs for years and emit alpha particles, intense radiation to a very, very localized spot within the lung, and that can lead to problems, as well as the toxic effects, because depleted uranium has not only radiological effects, it also has toxic effects as a heavy metal to the kidney and other organs. So that the military is using a testing procedure just for natural uranium and is not even using the most sensitive equipment that could detect smaller parts of depleted uranium that might be a reflection of that the uranium has settled somewhere else in the body, especially the lungs.
Darren, have other people in your unit been tested? Has everyone so far been tested?
I know of only one soldier who has been tested, and to believe me, he was the one that turned in his urine sample just before mine. That's why, and they have the result of him, but they don't have the result of me, which I find very intriguing.
And your company was the 719th Transport Company?
Yes, 719 Transport out of Harlem, New York.
Well, we want to thank you again very much for being with us. Gerard Darren Matthew, Guardsman's returned, his daughter born without most of her right hand, Ray Ramos, back from Iraq, from the 442nd Military Police, and Juan, thanks for doing the report. As we turn now to a story here in New Mexico, back in May of this year, radio station KNFT in Silver City began airing a new local talk show called Radio Free Silver. The one-hour morning program was broadcast 5 days a week and hosted by Kyle Johnson, a member of the Grant County Peace Coalition. Radio Free Silver was the sole hour of liberal programming amidst a slew of right-wing talk on KNFT's air, including 7 hours of Rush Limbaugh, Bill O'Reilly, and Michael Savage. But after just 2 months of broadcasting, Radio Free Silver was off the air. Why? Because 20 to 25 of the station's advertisers threatened to pull their spots, not only from Radio Free Silver, but from all of KNFT's programming, if RFS, Radio Free Silver, continued to be aired. KNFT's owner and station manager said that $10,000 a month in lost advertising revenue this would mean, and so was forced to drop the show. We're joined right now by Kyle Johnson, who is the former host of Radio Free Silver, and Matthew Runnels, who is the station manager and owner of KNFT in Silver City. We welcome you both to Democracy Now.
Good morning and welcome.
Matthew
to
Runnels,
Mexico.
Describe what... It's great to be with you here. Matthew Runnels, can you describe what happened when the trouble started? You're the station manager.
Well, good morning, Amy, and I appreciate you having Kyle and I on. Good morning, Ron, to you also. Essentially, like I say, I made the decision. One day, Kyle had come in with another gentleman and had spoke on another morning show that we had from 7 to 9 a.m., and I should say that these were on our AM station. We have an AM and an FM combination here. And so after Kyle had got off the air, I had quite a bit of controversy, people calling, saying, did you hear them? Do you know what they're talking about? And I said, no. But when Kyle walked out, I said, you know, Kyle, we evidently pushed a bunch of buttons there. So let's you and I look into doing a one-hour show. And essentially, he at first was going to just do it on Saturdays for 1 hour, and I convinced him that we need to try to do it 5 days a week. Once we got into it, like I said, there was a lot of turmoil over the show. We were threatened with a boycott by the Grant County Beef Association, and it just escalated into that. And, you know, $10,000 in New York is not a lot of money on a radio station. In small-town New Mexico, it's a tremendous amount. It's a large percentage. And so we just, because of pure economics, had to pull the show.
Kyle Johnson, what did you think at the time? Can you talk about the content of your program?
Yeah, Radio Free Silver, as I would describe it in the short, in a short phrase, is liberal, alternative, progressive viewpoints on the full range of issues. It wasn't strictly political. The range of issues included environmental things, health issues, universal health care. There are a lot of local water issues in New Mexico. There were issues of domestic violence, both from men's and women's viewpoints, other life, quality of life issues, dark skies, wolf reintroduction, the full gamut. And during the 2 months we were on, of course, I had approximately 40 guests, and these were almost all local people. So it wasn't just my voice that was being silenced. It was the voices of these members of the community, as well as the right of the public to hear and evaluate for themselves the full range of ideas in the marketplace of ideas.
And Kyle, what did you do to get the Beef Association upset, or what shows?
I'm a vegetarian.
But aside from that, did you have any guests specifically on the show that got
now,
them?
No, actually, as I drive in, I live out in Gila, so as I drive into Silver City, a half an hour drive, which is populated heavily by folks who are have cattle ranches, I see the big Pierce signs, not the ones that are 2 feet by 3 feet, but the ones that are 6 feet by 8 feet. And I think that the general tone of the show is one that they are very much opposed to. I think that Stephen Pierce is I would not be surprised, certainly if he's aware of this, but if he was even to some degree involved. So I think that it's a national issue, and I think that that kind of assessment is exactly what they didn't like, because even though I would talk about a range of issues, I would always look at them with some sense that, okay, it's a local issue here, but it's a national issue there. When you talk about universal health care, you can say, well, New Mexicans aren't covered. But why is that? It's because there's opposition at the national level, and it goes back to the beginning of the Clinton administration. It's probably why they were jumping on him for the entire 8 years, because they wanted to make sure that was a non-starter. And I think that those kinds of positions and policies and objectives that go out over years and cover large areas are fundamentally what's driving this.
And I'd like to...
Matthew Reynolds, just a quick question to Matthew Reynolds, the station manager. Did the companies in town, the local businesses, approach you en masse? And did you say, I mean, you've got Rush Limbaugh, you've got Bill O'Reilly, you've got Michael Savage. Why not allow in another viewpoint?
I was only approached by four or five. You have to remember I have five salesmen, and I was getting a lot of feedback from the salespeople on the streets. So if you multiply the people that I personally spoke to by the five salespeople I have, that's where you come up with 20, 25, 30 people. And no, it was not in mass. It was on a single basis. I did discuss that with them. And since then, we have changed some programming. We have a gentleman now named Ed Schultz that is on. Bill O'Reilly is on. We changed him from his spot from like 2 to 4 in the afternoon to 7 to 9 at night. And we don't run Michael Savage anymore. But yes, I did discuss that with him. Every time I listen to Kyle's show, because I am so busy, and I don't have time to sit and listen to the radio all the time. Every time I tuned in, four times, five times, they were talking about voter registration, people getting out and talking and, getting registered to vote and expressing their point of views, and water issues, which are very important to everybody. And so I never did see the content of the show ever being that offensive. Also, Kyle's a very intelligent, articulate gentleman. So, in a free society, if you don't have debate and you don't have somebody talking about other issues and discussing it, then you essentially just have a censorship. And it's really quite sad what has transpired.
Matthew, have you ever been approached by advertisers complaining that they would drop their advertising for Rush Limbaugh or Bill O'Reilly or Michael Savage?
We do. And whether on a national basis and on a local basis, there are a lot of people that don't want to be associated with any of that talk. Because they don't want it to look like they're either on the right or on the left or anywhere. They just don't. In fact, it's quite difficult to find anybody to do any of those shows. And at times we have looked at just dropping all of the talk shows and going to playing a different music format.
So in terms of the reaction to Kyle's show, what was markedly different then about that?
It was, like I say, it was just
pure out-and-out blackmail. And it was so venomous. I was shocked by the venomous remarks I were you know, was getting back from the salespeople and hearing myself. And I was pretty shocked and stunned and pretty disappointed more than anything, because I, you know, I really thought that everybody was human enough that they would, even if they didn't agree, because I don't agree 100% with what I do. You know, there's many a day I wake up and go, what was I thinking? But it's the type of scenario that I thought they would respect each other as one human being to another and allow it to keep going. But it just, it kept escalating to the point where it got to be economic blackmail.
Well, Matthew Reynolds and Kyle Johnson, we want to thank you for being with us from Silver City, reporting on the static there. When we come back from our break, we're going to Santa Cruz, California, where the FCC just moved in on a pirate radio station and shut it down. The FCC raided. Then we're going to speak with a leading feminist Native American writer about the opening of the Smithsonian Museum of the American Indian. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez. Amy Goodman is in Albuquerque. Yesterday morning at 9:20 in Santa Cruz, California, two dozen armed federal agents with automatic weapons and riot gear raided pirate radio station Radio Free Santa Cruz. The station had just finished airing its regular broadcast of Democracy Now! When the agents arrived on the scene. Moments after the initial raid, five agents from the Federal Communications Commission arrived. They located the transmitter and seized all of the station's broadcast equipment, including the antenna. More than 50 local residents showed up on the scene to protest the shutdown of the independent radio station. Free Radio Santa Cruz has been on the air operating without a license for nearly 10 years and has never been raided before yesterday. Despite its unlicensed status, the station recently won a resolution of support from the Santa Cruz City Council. We're joined by George Cadman, who has hosted a talk show on Free Radio Santa Cruz for more than 5 years. She was at the station when the raid began. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello.
So I guess that resolution from the Santa Cruz City Council was the kiss of death in terms of...
Well, actually, we've had two resolutions from the City Council in support of us, one which came many years ago, so I don't think that had anything to do with it, actually. About 100 people showed up to support us. There was about 15 U.S. Marshals and five FCC agents, roughly, that combed the property. And I was present when they arrived. Did you want to hear what happened?
Yes, please.
Okay, well, I was in the station. I came in to do the usual Wednesday morning programming. I put on our, you know, alternative news programming, Truth Out Overview, Independent Native News, Workers Independent News Service, and Democracy Now! Is on at 8. I believe Democracy Now! Played through our next show, Alternative Radio, was the one that got cut off. It was Howard Zinn. I put on the morning programming. I left the station. And I was walking to around the corner, and Democracy Now! Was on the air. I saw a number of unmarked kind of cop cars, undercover cop cars. And I became nervous. I wasn't sure right away what it was because it was around the corner. But as I was leaving, I saw them swarm the house. There was a bunch of riot marshals, U.S. marshals in riot gear that marched up to the property. At that point, I really didn't have any choice but to get to a phone and call as many people as I could. So I rushed to the closest payphone, called as many people as I could to come down. And, of course, you know, they also got on the phone and began calling people. Then I went back to the station, and when that had occurred, by the time I got back there, they had gotten everyone out of the house at gun. Many of them had their guns drawn, I learned later from some of the tenants. They had them lined up outside, whether they were in their underwear or a bathrobe. And some of them were pretty shaken up by it because they didn't, some of them weren't even fully aware that we were operating there because there's a high turnover in the house. And they were very supportive, though, and basically said very positive things regardless of the situation, although they felt very upset that they had not been shown a warrant yet. And 20 minutes went by before they were even shown a warrant, and then they were allowed to glance at one, not even read it. And also they weren't allowed in.
George, let me bring in Vinny Lombardo, who was in the house at the time that the FCC raided and shut down Free Radio Santa Cruz. Vinny, describe what happened.
I wasn't in the house. Actually, I showed up a few, like a half an hour after the FCC raid was already in progress. I formerly lived with Free Radio Santa Cruz for a number of years, but we moved in May. We relocated to a new spot, in Santa Cruz, and also a new spot on the dial, primarily to avoid interference complaints that had been lodged against our station. But what happened this morning, I mean, the agents, George pretty much described it. The agents came in, they kind of secured the property, kept the people that had gathered on the streets sort of away from the edges of the property. No arrests were made. They confiscated all our equipment, including antenna, transmitter, mixing board, 200 feet of coaxial cable, three CD players, a computer, a flat screen monitor, a Gentner phone box. The agents loaded up their vehicle and tried to drive away, and they were unable to drive away because somebody in the crowd, one of our, I don't know who, somebody slashed the tires on the vehicle and on a number of other vehicles as well around the area, a number of the marshals' vehicles that had been parked on the side street. So they had quite a difficult time getting away, and they had to basically listen to the community, the people that are losing their community voice, this outlet that we've had for 10 years in Santa Cruz, to be able to communicate with each other, share ideas, talk about politics, and things that are just not being talked about in mainstream news and corporate-controlled media. And these people were really upset to see their free speech, their voice taken away. So these agents, you know, got to hear that for a few more hours while they tried to repair their tires. But that's pretty much what happened.
So what are you going to do now, Vinny?
The collective, at this point, Free Radio is a collective group, and at this point we're still reviewing our options that are before us. Of course, we want to get back to serving our community and get back to our regular programming schedule. So we're going to use what we have to at our hands right now. We have a web stream going at freakradio.org where people can tune in on our web stream and listen to the station, at least temporarily. We'll be doing that until we review other options and see what we can do about getting back on the air. That remains to be seen how soon we can do that. So it's kind of, things are still being decided as we speak. We're going to have another meeting to discuss our options further over the next couple days.
Has there been any reaction from the city council that has twice before passed resolutions in support of the station?
Kennedy came down to support us, and he spoke to the media and basically said these are resources wasted right now in this time of, you know, supposed orange alerts and war and all that. He also said that he feels like this was against what the majority of Santa Cruz wanted. That we have a lot of support, and I want to emphasize how much support we have. We've had voicemail donated to us, equipment already. We've had money donated already. We had someone donate some silk-printed T-shirts, silk-screen T-shirts that they made, and lots of supportive phone calls, even from other radio stations. Other stations came through for us at this time. Five other stations in Santa Cruz announced on the air that we were being raided, gave out the address. It brought down a lot of supporters who are really the ones that are missing out right now, the listeners who came down to show support yesterday, who were very articulate about why they value and rely on our station. Many of them were talking to the marshals and the FCC agents and were very passionate about what we provide to them. So I want to focus back, you know, I just wanted to focus back on why we do what we do. I don't know if the city council is going to come out with a resolution or not, but the mayor was there. There was a couple of city council people that are running for city council that were there. And it shows you the level of support that we have, that the city council feels, you know, that it's important for them to show up for these things. I kind of want to make...
Being on and also... We also want to just point out that this follows what happened in Knoxville, Tennessee, with the FCC moving in on raiding KFAR. Ironically enough, KFAR stands for First Amendment Radio. And so this is the second raid in just about 1 or 2 weeks.
Yeah,
I want to thank you for being with us. Do you have a website people can go to get more information?
Yes, it's www.freakradio.org. That's F-R-E-A-K, freakradio.org.
Well, again, the latest news, FCC raiding Free Radio Santa Cruz, that has been there for about 10 years. Democracy Now! Has visited the studios there, and we thank you for being on with us as we move now to our last segment. Tens of thousands of Native Americans traveled to the nation's capital last week for the opening of the National Museum of the American Indian. And for many of them, for the first time, it truly was their capital. Nestled between the Air and Space Museum and the Capitol, the Museum of the American Indian takes up the last spot on the National Mall. Visitors can see more than 7,000 objects in the new museum. Some of them are more than 10,000 years old. Exhibits include food and stone carvings, face coverings from the northwest coast of North America, clothing and head coverings made of animal skins and feathers from the North American plains, clay pots, woven baskets, silver jewelry from the southwestern United States. While many applaud the idea behind the Smithsonian Museum of the American Indian, some groups, like the American Indian Movement, say there's not enough information about abuses inflicted by the U.S. government. AIM is calling for the museum to be renamed the National Holocaust Museum of the American Indian. We're joined here in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Paula Gunn Allen. She's a Native American writer and scholar, indigenous New Mexican of Laguna Puebla and Sioux descent, hailed as the founder of American Indian Literary Studies. She's a professor emerita of English at UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles. Her latest book, Pocahontas, Medicine Woman, Spy, Entrepreneur, Diplomat, received a 2004 Pulitzer Prize nomination. We welcome you to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Can you respond to the establishment of this museum?
It's an event. I've been sitting here trying to think of what's the word, and I'm a poet and I can't think of one. It creates in me and in everyone I've talked to since it opened, and I've been vaguely involved in it since the very beginning. I don't know, it's pride, it's relief, it's grief, it's anguish, it's joy, it's beauty. I read some of the press releases, and they don't like it because it doesn't do white stuff. And I'm rather interested that AIM wants us to attack the United States. But, you know, most of the folks don't see any point in that. What's important is that we're here. We're still occupied. There is no post-colonial Native America, and nor will there ever be, unless all of you want to leave, but that's not going to happen. So what we have is our statement of how we are. And that museum is about us telling each other about where we've been and what we've done, what's been going on. And the outsiders are very unhappy that it doesn't do what, I don't know, it's not scholarly enough, or it's not political enough, or it's not historical enough, or it's not ethnographic enough, it's not white enough. And as for the radical Indians, well, they have a point. They always have a point, and I'm half in agreement with them half of the time. But we're a little more conservative out here in the West, and actually I've been back east and talked to people from all kinds of tribes back there, and it isn't about confrontation to us. It's about we're here and we're not going anywhere. And 400, 500 years, you can't make us go away.
We're also joined on the telephone by Ramona Sacyustua. She is design consultant for the National Museum of the American Indian. She joins us from Santa Fe, where we were last night. You helped design this museum. Can you talk about its unusual design with no right angles, for example?
Well, good morning. Yes, I would like to just play off of what Paula and Alan said. The museum, even in its conceptual shape, reflects over 150 meetings with indigenous people from out the Americas, and this was a collective vision. And the shape is really in reference to the landscape and is carved from something that was over time to make you remember wind and water and what it does to the landscape. And there's a great deal of memory inherent in the landscape itself about Washington long before it was Washington, D.C., but when it was a wetland.
And can you just...
I'd like to ask...
Juan, go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to ask Ramona... In terms of the funding for the museum, did this come largely, was this the federal government or was this private sources? Or how did the museum come to life in terms of funding?
It was, this is really a question for Rick West, but in generalities it was the legislation for it was November 28, 1989, and the funding was both federal and had to be at least half privately funded, and I believe more than half was privately funded.
Well, Ramona Sacyustua, designer for the National Museum of American Indian, and Paula Gunn Allen, I want to thank you for being with us, and I hope to have you back, Paula Gunn Allen, to talk about your book, to talk about Pocahontas, and to talk about a different version of history in this country. That does it for today's program. Our producers are Mike Burke and Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, and Jeremy Scahill. I want to thank PBS station here in Albuquerque, KNME, for hosting us this morning, and a shout out to all the stations in New Mexico that broadcast Democracy Now! KUNM in Albuquerque broadcast our conversation last night at the Lensic Theater with Chalmers Johnson, KSFR in Santa Fe, Silver City, KATS, which is public access TV, also in Taos, Access Channel 2, in Las Cruces, Gallup, KGLP, and in Albuquerque, 3CTV. I'll be in Crested Butte, Colorado, Friday night, and in Potomac on Sunday. Go to our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.